This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I sat down with Warren Buffett in New York City this morning. We covered, among other things, who should be the next Treasury Secretary, how much the wealthy ought to pay in taxes, and whether he is worried about the future of democratic capitalism. We were joined by Carol Loomis. She's a senior editor-at-large at Fortune magazine who has put together a book of stories about Buffett called Tap Dancing to Work. Take a listen. Here you go. Thank you both for coming in.
Our pleasure.
Nice to be here.
Mr. Buffett, I want to start with you. You went on Charlie Rose last night, and you said Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, would make a fine Secretary of the Treasury when Timothy Geithner steps down. Why do you think so?
Well, I think he knows more about markets and than probably anybody you could find in the world. And I think that if in the next 4 years we run into some kind of a chaos in markets someplace, and who knows, you know, when that can happen, that he would. He would think better about it. He would command the respect of foreign leaders that he might have to coordinate with. I just think he's, you know, he'd be the guy I'd pick for that job.
Well, let's say the president picks him and he gets confirmed. Is that not a vote then for a little bit less regulation in the financial markets? He is no friend of regulation, as you know.
Jamie would not be espousing that, in my view. I mean, in the end, the president would set the tone on that. I do think that it would represent on both sides to a sort of a bygones be bygones, and business and this administration will work together. They'll have things they disagree on. There's no question about that. But I think the less the harsh the rhetoric and that sort of thing, the better. And I think Jamie would be a terrific Treasury Secretary.
You've been to Washington, right? You've met Congress and the president. I mean, these guys don't typically get along.
Well, I think they're going to learn to get along. They're going to have to play in the same sandbox, and that's an important sandbox.
We'll get back to that in a minute because that sandbox we got to follow up on.
Could I just add one thing?
Yes, ma'am, of course.
I've known Jamie for literally 26 years.
Mm-hmm.
I've known him when he was Sandy Weill's assistant. I've known him when he got fired by Sandy Weill, mm-hmm. didn't have a job. And he's a terrific guy. I'm with Warren in thinking he'd make a great Secretary of the Treasury.
All right, fair enough. Carol Loomis, the question of Warren Buffett and when you knew that he was somebody we all ought to pay attention to. And here's where I have to call you out a little bit. The first time he was in the magazine, Fortune magazine, 1966, you spelled his name wrong.
I did. He just autographed a book for my daughter, and he deliberately spelled it wrong.
That's almost mean. I don't know.
No. I'm trying to validate her mother's original.
What was it, though, that made you follow this guy?
Well, my that was in 1966 that I wrote one sentence about him and misspelled his name.
Yeah.
My husband met him probably early in 1967 and came home and said, I think I just met the best investor in the United States. And I feel like I rolled my eyes because, you know, husbands can engage in superlatives.
Mm-hmm.
And but then I met him maybe 2 months later with his first wife, the wonderful Susie Buffett. And I realized that Warren was unlike anyone I'd ever met. When he asked me what I did that morning at the office, I mentioned an obscure footnote that I'd seen in Coastal States Gas because I was working on the Fortune 500.
Yeah.
He knew all about it. I thought, this guy knows everything I'd like to know, and here I am getting the opportunity to talk to him, and we became friends, and we bought the stock soon after that. That is kind of the key to when we knew we've never sold.
You put your money where your mouth was. Right,
exactly.
Yeah. I've been trying to figure out, Mr. Buffett, through the course of reading this book, whether you are an investor or a businessman.
Both. And being an investor, you're buying pieces of a business, so you better understand business.
Yeah.
And being a businessman, you better understand alternatives for money in terms of allocating capital, and therefore you are partially an investor. So I've benefited in both roles by the fact that I was in the other one.
Do I have it right that you still get monthly, sometimes even weekly or daily numbers from your businesses? I read someplace you went over during the Christmas season, you went over the daily numbers for See's Candy, one of your businesses.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I called the office last night and got the candy figures. I hadn't gotten them since the day before Thanksgiving, and I got them daily. And I not only got them by the store, I got them by the holiday gift centers and also what we call our quantity order discount stores. I like numbers.
Wow. One would think you have better things to do with your time. No?
Well, I think you're exposing me.
That's all right with that.
There's a line in one of the stories in the books that says one of his subsidiary managers is talking to another, and this is before the second has been bought by Berkshire Hathaway. And the first guy says to the second, never tell him a number that you don't want him to remember, because he remembers every number he ever heard. And so that's an indicator of how much he's into numbers.
Could you be too much into numbers? Is that possible?
Well, business is a lot more than numbers. There's no question about that. People are key, and mm-hmm. so you have to be a judge of people. And now the numbers tell you certain things about people over time, but people are more important than numbers.
The other thing you like besides numbers is policy. I mean, you concentrate on it. You speak out on it occasionally. Most recently in the New York Times yesterday about raising taxes on the wealthy, the fiscal cliff, and the obligation and burdens that people ought to share. Do you think this is the time that we have an opportunity to actually do something about taxes and reform and debt and deficit in this country with the fiscal cliff coming?
Oh, I think we will. And, we've kicked it down the road for a long time. But D-Day is here, and that doesn't mean we'll get the fiscal cliff problem solved by December 31st. I hope we do. But it may go over into January. But we are going to have to address important policy questions, and I think Congress knows it. I think the president knows it, and certainly the American public knows it.
Why are you so confident, though? Because that's not the noise that's coming out of Washington.
Yeah, well, I can understand a certain amount of skepticism, but it's an interesting situation, because I would say that 90% of the Republicans and 90% of the Democrats understand that you have to raise about 18.5% or thereabouts of GDP and revenue, and they mm-hmm. know that you can spend about 21% and it'll work out okay. They also know that the present course is not sustainable. So you do have this situation, though, where I think you could get a majority of the Democrats and a majority of the Republicans to agree on a policy, but that doesn't mean that necessarily the Republican Party will come around, because both the far right and the far left may get very intransigent. And that scares the Republicans more than the Democrats.
Yeah. You're being really measured here, and I appreciate that you understand the weight that your words carry in this economy. Do you not think, though, that you could speak out forcefully and oblige people to get something done using this role you've built over the past 55, 60 years in this economy?
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't put it that strongly. But when I wrote the op-ed piece for the New York Times, yeah. I was giving something of a blueprint, and I really challenged Congress to come up with this 18.5 and 21 mixture, which, as I say, millions of Americans understand that's the answer, and I would say a majority of the Congress does. They just they're afraid of primaries to some extent.
Yeah. Is your phone ringing off the hook with the Speaker and the Senate Majority Leader calling you saying, Warren, this is a great idea?
No.
Yeah. Carol Loomis, you say at one point in this book, acknowledging your role as the editor of Warren's annual letter to shareholders and a close collaborator for many years, you guys have one knockdown, drag-out fight a year about you editing his copy.
Well, I wouldn't say we've ever come to physical blows.
No.
No, you're tough, though. She's
more than 1,000 miles away to start with.
Well, I tell you, we don't do it over the telephone, because we tend to get a little tense over the telephone. So we send drafts back and forth with my suggestions, quote unquote, because that's really all I can do is suggest a change that I think would be good for the end report and for the reader, and then Warren accepts what he thinks is the right thing to do, and then we have another draft, and this goes back and forth for quite a while.
Are you changing small cat to little puppy, or small cat to little dog, or what are you changing?
Well, sometimes I change passive verbs to active verbs.
Do you write in the passive voice?
I must have missed it in high school or something. Carol has been telling me for 30 or 40 years that I have to stick with the active.
She's doing the right thing as an editor.
Well, she is. She is. There's no question about it. She is an enormous help on this.
And I say to him, well, you know, that's something you could learn. And he said, well, it just doesn't come naturally to me. And I say, well, some of the investing things you suggest – don't come too naturally to me either, but I try to learn them.
Yeah. Anyway. Well, I like to make a few of these mistakes over and over again just to keep her on her toes.
Fair enough.
And sometimes I'll just suggest a word. We have a friend who calls it the inevitable word. You're a journalist.
Word?
You would the inevitable word. I use it a lot of times in conversation because there really are some words for a given situation that is an inevitable word.
That's true. But you never know it until you actually get there. Right?
Yeah, but that's right. But you have to do whatever it is to get to the inevitable word.
That's true. You have edited his shareholder letter for many, many years.
Right.
And Mr. Buffett, you said yesterday in your comments about Jamie Dimon that his shareholder letter every year is something to read. Yours is characterized often as the same thing. Why do you think shareholder letters are so important?
Well, I think that I'm working for 600,000 people who have entrusted their money to me, and they are entitled to hear not from some public relations firm that writes it or some investor relations person. They're entitled to hear from me exactly what I'm thinking about, what I worry about, how I see our businesses. I mean, the title is report. It's not an advertisement or a sales document. So we don't have any pictures in our report. And I try to talk to the shareholders as I would talk to my two sisters who were important shareholders, and be totally candid about what worries me, what I feel good about, what I really think some parts of the businesses are worth, whatever I think is important to them.
We talked about Congress a little bit. We talked about the president a little bit. There's another economic center of power in Washington that I want to get your thoughts on. Ben Bernanke, his policy of quantitative easing, and how much more you think the Fed can do to help this economy, if anything.
Well, I think they've used up their bullets pretty much. When you drive interest rates to zero and when you buy almost a couple $1 trillion worth of securities, and now you start buying longer-term securities. Yeah, you've done your part, then. I mean, Ben has given it the office. Now it's up to Congress.
That's a good line. Do you think Congress is going to take up the challenge?
Sure. Yeah, they will. Well, they've danced around it for quite a while. I mean, I think it's kind of interesting that 15 months ago or whenever it was, they said, we're going to set up a fiscal cliff, and then they've been driving their car down the same highway right to the edge of the cliff when they've had all kinds of opportunities to drive off and drive around the cliff. But I think the American people, with their opinion of Congress that they've expressed, I think the message has gotten through that we've got to get serious about this.
Do you think the current situation that we find ourselves in, that Congress finds itself in, puts, and this is a little grand, but I'll see what you say, puts the basic premise of democratic capitalism at risk? I mean, we can't decide what to do with this economy.
No, I think that you're seeing, you know, a lot of partisanship. You are seeing this situation where the primary becomes the election that many congressmen are worried about much more than the final election. And that makes them worry about whether they're satisfying the more extreme of their base to some degree. So those are all problems, but we've had all kinds of problems in this country. 535 people can't stop the progress of 312 million, I promise you that.
When you have your annual shareholders meeting out in Omaha, it is something of a festival. You take questions from shareholders. You chat with them. What's the weirdest question you ever got, the strangest?
I had one when the stock wasn't doing so well. I had one young woman that stood up and said, "You know, my dad bought me this stock to put me through college," and she says, "Now I'm afraid I'm going to have to go to correspondence school."
Wow.
I like tough questions. As a matter of fact, we're going to do something very unusual at this meeting. We're going to have one set of questions directed from somebody that basically represents the short interest people who would be short the stock. I like bringing out things at the meeting. I want to get interesting for the people to come.
What are there, like three people in the world who are short Berkshire Hathaway now?
I don't know. We'll find them.
What's the most important thing that anybody has to know about Warren Buffett?
Well, I think the central thing about Warren, and people ought to understand it, is that he is totally rational about investing, and he's not. Most people are gripped by emotion when they're considering the investment. The stock goes down, and they panic and they sell. Warren just buys more because he's got a value theory built into his first purchase, and now it goes down lower, as he says. So when hammers go down, we love it at the Buffett House. Hmm. And why wouldn't we love it when stocks go down? So rationality is a central part of how he has spent his life investing and building Berkshire Hathaway, and it's marvelous.
You have this reputation as this oracle, the Oracle of Omaha. People hang on your every word. Do you deserve it?
No.
But, not true.
Carol says I'm rational, and I am. I mean, but that's not limited to me. I mean, I'm in a business where temperament is more important than IQ. So I would not do well trying to play top-notch chess. And I can't play top-notch bridge. I can play reasonable bridge. I mean, there's all kinds of things I can't do. But I can think rationally about business and investments. And most people let their temperament interfere with that. They get excited when other people get excited. They get depressed when other people get depressed.
It's funny. You say rational. The word that comes to my mind is cold-blooded, and you don't seem like a cold-blooded kind of guy.
No. I have normal human emotions, believe me. But being rational means that when I try to decide whether a stock is worth $100 a share or $200 a share, I look at the facts and I don't care what other people say. I don't care whether, you know, that morning on television, people were saying the stocks are going to the moon, or the stocks are going to tank, or whatever it may be. I don't pay any attention to what other people are saying about something. I just look at the facts. But I can be an emotional guy. Just watch me in a Nebraska football game.
fair enough. You have said that you don't invest in things you don't understand, that you can't get a handle on, which follows on this rational side of yours. What don't you understand now about this economy, about the companies in it?
Well, it's that I don't understand what the future is going to be like for some business or industry. I don't know what auto company will be the winner 10 years from now. I do know what soft drink company or chewing gum company will be the winner 10 years from now. So there's some businesses that are just much easier to analyze than others.
Hmm. Interesting. Carol Loomis, you have been a friend, an investor, a professional collaborator with Warren Buffett for 45 years.
Not doing all those things.
But, yeah. Uh-huh. How do you maintain a sense of objectivity about him?
It's essential that he's a good guy to begin with. I in effect, fortune picked the right horse when we began to cover him so closely. And I don't find it hard to maintain objectivity about Warren at all. I probably understand more of his character than most people, but almost all of that character is really good. So it's not hard to maintain objectivity at all.
You say somewhere in this book that you wouldn't be qualified to write an actual biography of him because you're just too close. I wonder, though, if what we have in this collection of articles from Fortune is sort of a biography of American capitalism from, say, 1955-ish to today.
I think that's a very good description. I've called it a business biography. I think maybe I like your description better.
It
really is. It is a business biography of Warren from the first time we mentioned him in 1966 right up to date, in which he kept doing new and interesting things. So we always had something that was crying out for us to write about. And then he moved into the philanthropy part of his life. And we were very lucky at that point that it took me 6 years to get this book done, because there were a lot of chapters that wouldn't have been in it if I'd moved faster.
To some extent, it's a business biography in real time, as opposed to waiting till the end of a life and then sort of interpreting all the events that went along. I mean, this is how things looked at the time. The reason it isn't a total biography is Carol knows too much about me.
Look back for me then from your start in this business in 1951 and a 30-year-old Warren Buffett. I mean, could you have imagined that this economy would turn out the way it has today?
No, but I was always bullish on the economy and the American economy. I always felt I was very, very lucky to be born in this country and that there was more opportunity here than anyone else, anywhere else. I would not have accomplished remotely what I have if I'd been born in, you know, just dozens of other countries.
You've been bullish on the American economy for your whole working life. I mean, forever. Are you still, even today, with the political problems we have, with the recession that's dragging, with ordinary Americans who sort of can't believe they can ever get ahead again, are you still bullish?
More bullish than ever. I mean—
Why?
This country since 1776 has had the secret of unlocking human potential, and it's been doing it. I mean, we're not any smarter than people were in 1776, and we don't work any harder, but— all kinds of things that we found that we can do. And that game is far, far, far from over. We have a system, and some of the world has been copying it in recent years, which is terrific.
But don't you believe that makes it harder? I mean,
no, the rise
of the rest and all of that?
That's terrific. I mean, I do not want America to be an island of 300 million people on a sea of 7 billion that are suffering. No. Be kind of crazy, particularly if they have nuclear bombs and a few things.
What's your biggest worry? What's your biggest fear about the American economy?
Well, I really don't have any. I don't have a fear about.
Oh,
the American economy.
On!
No, I really don't. I mean, sure, there are all kinds of problems. Every year, I could sit down with a yellow pad and write down 20 problems that the country faced. I mean, I could have done that when I was 20 years old. I could do it now, but we've still got a machine that moves forward. It doesn't do it. You know, it's in fits and starts, and, you know, we have our bubbles, and we have our the bubbles pop and all of that sort of thing. We had a civil war. We had, you know, two world wars. We had the Great Depression. But if you look at the markers as to where the tide is going, I mean, it just keeps coming in.
I want to touch briefly on your philanthropic efforts, and not the mechanism, not the whys, not the hows. But where do you go from here? So, I mean, eventually this ends up with you no longer on the scene and all your money dispersed. What do you hope happens after that?
I just hope that the money contributes very significantly to the welfare of millions of people around the world. I mean, there are all kinds of people that have gotten the short straws in life, and there are people that need much better health care than they get. There are people that need much better educations than they get. I have a whole bunch of claim checks in effect in the stock. Yeah. They could buy me castles or, you know, whatever it might be. But they don't have any real utility to me. They have tremendous utility, or they have the potential for tremendous utility for millions of people around the world. And, you know, health is an obvious area. I mean, I have access to all kinds of, you know, whatever problem I have, I can go see five doctors in 10 minutes. And people around the world do not have access to the simplest of vaccines in many cases. And you know, my money will buy that, or it'll buy me a yacht. The yacht won't do me any good, and I wouldn't have any fun on it anyway. And it will do some real things for people around the world.
Why do you think the ideas that you set forth in your op-ed yesterday in the Times about a minimum tax for the extremely wealthy and for raising tax rates and all of that, why do you think that is so hard to get traction on in Washington today?
Well, because if you look at the tax code is essentially an act of war. You know, you talk about class war, but people fight, you know, through the tax code, and the wealthy fight through lobbyists, and they fight through lawyers, and they fight through campaign contributions, and my cleaning lady, you know, she doesn't even have a water pistol in that fight. So people. And they're human beings, and, you know, they fight to have no estate taxes. They fight to have special capital gains rates on, you know, on what really is ordinary labor through carried interest. They will fight, and they're not going to give that up. So when I propose, here you have the 400 highest incomes in the United States, and you have six people paying no tax at all. They like it, and you have to get people incensed enough, really, that through their elected representatives, they do something about that.
If you were 30 years old and you had, I don't know, $30,000 or even $3,000 in this economy today, what would you do with it?
I'd go out and start doing what I did. What 60 did years ago? Yeah, yeah, it worked okay.
One last thing before I let you go: who is going to take over Berkshire Hathaway when you're done?
Well, the name of that person is known to all the directors, and if I die tonight, tomorrow morning they will pull that name out and put that person in charge. And if for some reason that person wouldn't do it, and there really would be no reason, but then there's a couple backup candidates as well.
Is it a person like you?
It's a person that certainly in terms of managing businesses, my job will get broken into two parts, one managing investments and one managing the business. And the CEO will be the person that manages the business. And that person has a similar philosophy of business management to mine and is totally imbued with the Berkshire culture.
I lied. This is actually the last question. It just occurred to me. You actually say somewhere in the writings in this book that buying Berkshire Hathaway in 1965 or whatever it was a mistake.
Correct.
Why?
Well, I started with a textile business that was doomed for failure. It took me 20 years to realize that. But I would have been far better off if I'd put these better businesses in over time into an entity that was not burdened by a textile business. Originally, all of our capital was in that textile business. And even 5 years after I took it over, half the capital was in it. So I was lugging along this terrible business, which I thought I would be a genius and somehow make good. And, of course, I flopped. So if I'd done the other things without the burden of the textile business, I'd have been far richer and so would shareholders.
The book by Carol Loomis about the working life of Warren Buffett is called Tap Dancing the Work. Thank you both very much for coming in.
Nice to be here.